hard when you get angry. I don't know why I've always assumed that since I was the one to take you, I would also be the one who decided when to let go. I didn't have a choice, I say. But my words curl under at the ends, like a beaten dog's tail. You had a choice, you answer. But it's what you don't say that slices through me like a clean blade. And you made the wrong one. For a long time, after we ran away, we both had nightmares. Mine involved you holding your mother's hand, stepping off the curb into a wall of oncoming traffic. I'd lurch forward to push you out of the way, only to discover that I'd been watching from behind a glass wall. I'd listen to the scream of brakes and your high cries, knowing I could not reach you. When you leave the visiting area, I drop the phone and press my hands to the glass. I bang on it, but you can't hear me. Your nightmares used to be about getting left behind. You'd rip the seam of sleep wide open and wake up, damp and sobbing. I'd rub your back until you fell asleep again. Nightmares don't come true, I'd soothe. As it turns out, I was lying about that, too. Instead of going back to my cell, I wander around the pod. There is a communal area where some of the inmates are playing cards or watching television. The toilet facilities are in the cells, but there is a room with showers off in the rear corner. It's empty now, and that's enough reason for me to duck inside. In the aftermath of your visit, I am moving slowly, as if swimming underwater. I had hoped to see you because I'm selfish, but now I wish you hadn't come. It's only made me more sure of what I told Eric before I was extradited from New Hampshire. I am no longer a source of protection for you, but a source of pain. I heard as much minutes ago, in the cramped breaths you took between sentences. For the first time in your life, you wondered if you'd have been better off without me. I gave up my life once trying to do what's best for you. Tomorrow, in front of a judge, I'll do it again. I'm leaning my forehead against the cool tile of the shower area when a shadow falls behind me. Styx is there, surrounded by a brace of men as large as he is, their tattooed arms folded and their bodies blocking the exit. I'm no punk, Styx says. The next thing I know, I am splayed on the floor, my head ringing from a blow. There is an impossible weight on my legs, and I can feel my pants being ripped down. I try to curl up into a ball, but he starts hitting at my face and my gut. I try to yell for help. As his hands lock onto my legs, I start kicking anywhere, anything, because I'm not going to let this happen. I am not. I start sewing together all the fury I've been gathering together since the moment the police took me out of my kitchen in Wexton days ago. I let loose the panic I've stored for 28 years about being found out. So when his arm anchors me at the waist, when his hips are parenthetical to mine, I reach out for the bar of soap on the shower floor. I twist, shove it into his grinning mouth. He lets go of me immediately and I roll to the side, dry heaving and grabbing at my clothes. I can't think of you in here. I can't think of anything but me. And I won't be left alone, not even if I try to fade into the background. Everyone else will just pick at me until they see what color I bleed. That's all I can hold in my head before everything goes black. When I fall asleep in jail, it is never dark, and I'm never tired. So I find myself imagining what got me in here in the first place, twisting it into a Mobius strip in my mind. I don't count sheep. I count days. I don't pray. I barter with God. I make a list of the things I've taken for granted because I always thought I would have access to them. Meat that requires a knife, pens, caffeinated coffee, a child's belly laugh, a butterfly's tango, paperwork, pitch dark, snow clouds, utter quiet, you. I open one eye, the only one that works, and find myself staring at a short, muscular black man who is picking through a collection of food. It is nearly dark, and the door to the cell is locked. He takes an orange and slips it under his mattress. I try to sit up, but feel like I've been beaten from head to heel. "Who are you?" He turns as if surprised to discover that I'm alive. "Concise. That's your name? It's what the ladies call me. Because I may be short, but man, am I sweet." He takes a handful of carrots and eats them. "Hope you weren't counting on dinner," he says, pointing to what must have been my tray. "What happened to..." "Sticks?" Concise grins. "The motherfucker got a D." "A D? He in disciplinary segregation for a week." "Why didn't I get one?" "Because even the DOs know. You get called a punk, and you either gotta fuck or fight." He turns a sharp eye on me. "Don't be getting comfortable. No way are you staying here for good. They didn't want to mix races at all, but I was all they got open. Right now, it would not matter to me if Concise was African-American, Hispanic, or Martian." He takes a postcard from the pocket of a striped shirt and sticks it through the bars at the front of the cell. On the door, he has fashioned a mailbox made of plastic spoons. There is even a little flag, collared in with red magic marker. I wonder whether, if you rot here long enough, you grow a thicker skin. I wonder if prison is any different from this. Once I go to court and enter a guilty plea, that's where I'll be headed. For years. Maybe one for each I stole from you. I try to roll over and wince at the fire in my kidneys. "Why are you here?" I ask. "Because the damn Ritz was full up," Concise says. "What kind of fool question is that? I mean, why are you in jail? 6 months for dealing. Would have been 3, but I already done time before." "That's the thing about a habit. It's like a pet, man. It don't go away just because you're in here. It's waiting to jump all over you the minute you walk back onto the street." From my vantage point on the bottom bunk, I look up and see the steel tray holding the upper mattress. I look at the tack welds and wonder how much weight they can support. "Sticks, he one tough cracker, man. He thinks he owned this pod." Concise shakes his head. "We all wondering who the hell you are." I close my eyes and think of all the people I have been in my lifetime. A boy who fell in love with a broken girl 1,000 years ago. A father holding a newborn and thinking that nothing could ever make him let her go. A man starving for one more moment with his little girl. A fugitive on the run. A liar. A cheat. A felon. Maybe the habit that is always waiting to jump me on the other side of the fence is revival. Maybe I will do absolutely anything to wipe the slate clean. To start over. Call me Andrew, I say.
Eric. The law offices of Hamilton, Hamilton, and Hamilton Thorpe are located in downtown Phoenix, in a mirrored building that scares the hell out of me when I walk up close and see that ghost of myself coming forward. Chris, the second Hamilton in the name lineup, went to law school with me in Vermont, knowing all along he had a nice cushy job waiting at his father's firm, the first Hamilton in the name lineup. The newest partner, the hyphenated one, is Chris's little sister, recently graduated from Harvard Law. In order to try a case pro hac vice in a different state, you need a sponsoring local attorney. Actually, it's similar to AA, where someone older and wiser mentors you in the hopes that you do nothing to embarrass yourself. Chris is a former diver with the face of a choir boy. He used to be able to charm professors into extensions without breaking a sweat. When I called and asked him to be my Arizona counsel, he didn't even hesitate before agreeing. "I ought to tell you about the case," I had said. "Who cares?" Chris answered. "It's an excuse to go out and have a few beers." I didn't tell him I no longer do that. He was in court yesterday when I arrived at the law office in a mad rush, trying to contact the New Hampshire Bar Association. His sister, Serena, graciously ceded me the conference room at Hamilton, Hamilton, and Hamilton Thorpe, a vast expanse of paneled wood and barrister bookcases and brass-studded leather chairs. No one is in the office this morning when I let myself in with my newly minted key, but then it is only 6:45 a.m. After yesterday's debacle with my non-existent bar card, I'm determined to read up on Arizona case law before visiting hours begin at the jail. I find myself staring at the legalese, all those blocks of type and tiny letters morphing into one another, until all I can make out on a page is the shape of a man holding out his hand and a little girl reaching to grab it. I was 10 years old, and in serious training for the CIA. I had a walkie-talkie, a black stocking balaclava, a flashlight, and a cheat sheet for Morse code. To practice, I was going to spy on my mother in the living room, although I was supposed to still be outside catching June bugs in old Jif peanut butter jars. She was on the phone when I crept in on cat feet and flattened myself behind the couch with my tape recorder. "He's a son of a bitch is all," she said. "Well, you know what? She can have him. She can have his pyramid schemes and his big promises and all his Casanova bullshit." I turned on the tape recorder and realized too late that I had hit play. And worse, that the Halloween screams of a dozen humpback whales were filling the room. My mother jumped and peeked over the back of the couch, narrowing her eyes in a death laser. "Andrea, I have to call you back," she said. A good CIA agent would unspool the tape and eat the evidence, I thought. A good CIA agent would pull a cyanide pill from the folds of his suit and go down as a hero for his mission. My mother yanked me up by the ear. "You liar," she said. Those long vowels, a boozy breeze across my face. "You're just like him." She slapped me so hard across the head that I actually saw stars. And for a minute, I was amazed that this could actually happen. That it wasn't just something you saw in a cartoon. I cowered, hating myself for that. Hating her. And then, just as suddenly, she was behind the couch with me, her octopus hands smoothing my hair and kissing my face and rocking me. "Baby, I didn't mean to," she said. You forgive me, don't you? You know I'd never hurt you. You and me, we're in this together, aren't we? I stood up and backed away from her. I got invited next door for dinner, I said, and a red flare went off in my head. I was a liar. Well, you go then, she replied, and she smiled her loose smile, the one that she used when she was embarrassed, not to be confused with the bright smile, the one she wore when she was completely lit, or the fake smile, the one that made my stomach feel like a cello strung too tight. Outside, the neighborhood was painted like a hand-colored photo. Nearly too dark to make out the reds of the peeling shutters or the snowflake blue of the hydrangeas, I headed for Delia's house but stopped as I came around the corner. Their kitchen window burned buttery as a candle, and inside, I could see Delia and her father eating dinner. Fried chicken. Her father had both of the drumsticks in his hands, and he was making them do a can-can across the platter toward Delia. I sat down on the lawn. I didn't really want to interrupt them, I realized. I just wanted to know that somewhere in a household, this was going on.
Eric, man, if you keep working this hard, you're going to get me disinherited.
Chris laughs, and I jump awake with a start, my heart leaping like a fish pulled through 6 leagues of sea. I smooth my rumpled tie and rub my hand down my face. There is a crease in my cheek, the result of lying on top of an open book. Chris doesn't look much different from how he did years ago in law school. The same relaxed posture, the same sandy blonde hair, the same comfortable expression of a man who knows the world will always go his way. "So, welcome to the family business," he says. "My sister said she got you settled yesterday. Sorry I couldn't be the one." "Serena was great," I reply, clearing my throat. "And the office is terrific." Chris sits down across the table from me. Must be a pain in the ass having to become fluent overnight in Arizona law. "I didn't think you had law down here. Isn't it still 10 paces, turn, and draw your weapon?" Chris laughs. "Only half the time. You're forgetting the posses." He takes a sip of coffee. Just the smell of it makes me salivate. But I gave up caffeine with booze. The blood rush was too similar, and I didn't want to tempt my body with the feel of a high. These days, I will not even take an aspirin for a garden variety headache. Chris lifts his mug toward me. "There's more if you want some. Just brewed." "Thanks, but I don't drink coffee." "That's inhuman, you know." He sits forward, his elbows on the table. "So I suppose you should tell me about this case if I have to be second chair. Must be a pretty important client if he convinced you to haul your butt to Arizona to fight some charge." "He is pretty important," I answer. "He's my fiancé's father. He got indicted for kidnapping her during a custody visit in 1977. Chris's eyes widen. "I am never going to complain about my in-laws again." I leave out the part about how Andrew as good as confessed to me at the Wexton PD, how he expressed the desire to plead guilty, and how I swore to Delia that I wouldn't let that happen. To try a case in another state, your professional conduct must be impeccable. I have already failed on 2 counts. Delia asked me to represent him. I haven't even seen Andrew since he was extradited. I spent the whole afternoon yesterday trying to convince the staff at the Madison Street Jail that I'm really a lawyer and don't just play one on TV. The secretary sticks her head into the conference room. "Oh, good, Mr. Talcott. You're awake," she says, and a flush of embarrassment spreads over my collar. Your fiancé wants you to call her immediately. Something about your daughter being sick. Sophie? I ask, but I'm already reaching for the phone. Sick as in head cold or sick as in bubonic plague? I dial Delia's cell number and get her voicemail. Call me, I say, and then I look up at Chris. Maybe I should swing by home, make sure she's all right. This came for you too, the secretary says, and she passes me a fax. It's a letter from the New Hampshire Bar Association stating I'm a member in good standing. I ought to go check on Sophie, but I also need to talk to Andrew in jail. I have a feeling this isn't the last time I'll be asked to choose between Delia's present life and her past. Which came first, the addict or the drug? You can't have an addiction unless there's something to crave. By the same token, a drug is nothing but a plant or a drink or a powder until someone wants it badly. The truth is, the addict and the drug came together, and therein lies the problem. When you want something desperately, you shake with the need for it. You tell yourself you don't need more than one sip because it's just the taste you crave. And once it's on your tongue, you'll be able to make it last a lifetime. You dream of it at night. You see 1,000-mile-high obstacles between where you stand and what you want, and you convince yourself you have the power to hurdle them. You tell yourself this even when, leaping the first block, you wind up bruised and bloodied and flattened. I have been fooling everyone for years. Sure, I've given up alcohol, but that was nothing compared to my other addiction. Love is the most dangerous craving of all, if you ask me. It turns us into people we aren't. It makes us feel like hell and makes us walk on water. It ruins us for anything else. I watch her doing the simplest things, brushing her hair into a ponytail, feeding the dog, tying Sophie's shoelaces, and I want to tell her what she means to me. But I never actually say the words. After all, to acknowledge Delia as a drug, I'd have to face the fact that one day I might have to go without her. And this I can't do. Inside the lobby of the Madison Street Jail, a spot I became all too familiar with yesterday, are a bank of blue chairs and a wall-mounted television. Against one wall is a line of bank teller windows with signs posted above to separate visitors from attorneys only. I approach that window, feeling like the first-class airline passenger bypassing the masses. The woman staffing the position remembers me from yesterday. "You're back," she says sourly. I offer my best smile. "Good morning." I push the letter from the New Hampshire Bar Association through the slit at the bottom of the plexiglass window. "See? I told you I was a genuine attorney." "Genuine attorney? That's one of those whatchamacallits. You know, like jumbo shrimp and working vacation and military intelligence?" "Oxymoron. Hey, you want to call yourself names? Fine with me." She picks up a pen. "Which inmate did you want to see?" While I wait for a detention officer to lead me into the jail, I sit in the bank of chairs and watch TV with some of the other visitors. Some have brought children who bounce on their laps like popcorn. The show currently airing is some sort of court TV, or so I think, until I read the sleeve badge of one of the bailiffs standing beside the judge's bench. Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. At that point, I realize that this must be a closed-circuit film of some arraignment process that goes on inside the jail itself. "La mirada," the lady next to me says proudly, pointing at the television monitor so that her toddler will look. "No es papá guapo." When my name is called, a beefy officer leads me to a metal detector and then takes a cluster of keys from his belt to open a door that leads to an airlock about 3 feet square. From inside a control room, the inner door opens, admitting us into the jail. We take an elevator up to the fourth floor visiting area. Another detention officer holds court over a small assortment of inmates. Some speak to their attorneys in private rooms. A long central section features dozens of individual non-contact visit booths. One inmate is chained to a stool, holding a phone in his hand. On the other side of a glass wall, a woman is crying.
"You can wait here," the detention officer says. "We'll go get your client."
Here turns out to be a side room with a fluorescent light that hisses and spits like a wet cat. From this vantage point, I can't see the inmate anymore, but I can see the woman visiting him. She has leaned forward now and is kissing the glass. When I was 11, I caught Delia making out with the bathroom mirror. I asked her what she was doing. "Practicing," she informed me, matter of fact. "You might want to think about it, too." After a while, I glance at my watch. 20 minutes have gone by. I stand up and try to locate the detention officer. He's on the other side of the visiting room, bent over the Arizona Republic sports page. "Excuse me," I say. "Has anyone found my client yet? Andrew Hopkins?" The man gives me a blank stare, but he crosses the room and picks up a phone. He speaks into it for a few moments and then returns to me.
"They thought someone came down to tell you. Your client's already been brought next door to court."
This ends Disc 4. Vanishing Acts, Disc 5.
I call Chris Hamilton on my cell phone as I'm flying up the steps of the East Courthouse. "How fast can you be here?" I demand. As my sponsoring attorney, he has to be present in the courtroom, even if my pro hac vice motion has been granted. I don't have time to call Delia, and I know she is going to kill me for that. But then, Andrew is about to face a judge without me, a judge to whom he plans to plead guilty. The court building is 10 times larger than any court in New Hampshire. A bailiff runs a metal detector just inside the entrance. A woman holds tight to a little boy's hand as she sets her purse on the conveyor belt. Attorneys crossing the lobby drift toward each other, making deals over cups of coffee. In the chairs, waiting, are sequestered witnesses in their itchy suits and welfare kids with coloring books and the personal recognizance returnees, their baggy pants riding low and their toques pulled down past their eyebrows. I try to find a clerk who can tell me on which of the 9 floors and in which of the 20 courtrooms Andrew will be appearing, but no one seems to have that answer. So I run to the sheriff's office inside the court, the holding pen where inmates are kept waiting until they appear. The deputy at the desk has a Doc Holliday mustache and a Buddha belly.
"All's I know," he says, "is that if it's an arraignment, you're in the wrong damn courthouse."
I'm running over to the other courthouse, the central courthouse, when I see Chris hurrying toward the building. This one has 13 stories with 5 courtrooms. One look at the line for the elevators and I'm following him up a staircase. We reach the 5th floor gasping. "Not guilty arraignments," he explains, and we burst into courtroom 501 together like a comic book duo come to save the day. I wish I could say I'm filled with confidence when I walk into that courtroom, but if I'm going to be honest, I don't have a very good track record with success. It took me 2 attempts to pass the bar. I started AA 3 times and then proceeded to once again drink myself into oblivion. I have no reason to believe that this latest challenge will be any different. The judge is the most imposing justice I have ever seen. He easily weighs 300 pounds, has flyaway gray hair, and fists the size of Easter hams. A placard on the bench announces him as the Honorable Caesar T. Noble. "I can't believe you drew that judge," Chris says under his breath. "We call him No Bull." The inmate, sitting alone at the defense bench, gets to his feet his ankle chains jingling. Standing, his profile is visible. It is Andrew.
Mr. Hopkins, I see you don't have counsel present, so I'm going to ask you to enter a plea, the judge says.
I start running down the center aisle. There is a saying sometimes chanted at AA meetings. Fake it until you make it. I've done it before. I can do it again. The judge, hell, everyone in the room, looks to me.
Excuse me, Noble says, as I hurdle the bar and step up beside Andrew, squeezing his shoulder. Would you please identify yourself?
Eric Talcott, Your Honor. I'm an attorney licensed to practice in the state of New Hampshire, but I've filed a motion to appear before you pro hac vice. My sponsor for the state of Arizona is Christopher Hamilton, and I'm certified to practice in this courtroom, provided the motion has been granted. The judge glances down at his file and then back up to me.
Sir, you are out of order. Not only don't I have this alleged pro hac vice motion, but I find it extremely disrespectful that you've come whooping into my courtroom and interfered with my proceedings.
He narrows his gaze until it nicks at my throat.
Maybe that's the way y'all do things in New Hampshire, but here in Arizona, we don't.
Your Honor, Chris says, smoothly stepping over the bar to stand next to me. If you please, I'm Chris Hamilton, and I'm responsible for that pro hac vice motion. We asked the clerk's office to bring the motion either to Your Honor or to another judge who might be in a position to sign it quickly, knowing, as I do, that Your Honor prefers, understandably, to have everything in order. Chris couldn't come any closer to kissing this guy's considerable ass. Apparently, in Arizona, that actually works. The judge beckons to the clerk of the court.
Call over and see if there's any kind of motion that's been filed and granted.
The clerk picks up the phone and mouths words that don't carry any volume. I have never understood how they quite do that, but it's the same in every court. When he hangs up, he turns to the judge. Your Honor, Judge Umatayo just granted the motion.
Mr. Talcott, this is your lucky day, Noble says, without a trace of hospitality. How does your client plead?
I make sure not to look at Andrew when I speak. Not guilty. Andrew stiffens, whispering. You told me. Under my breath, I cut him off. Not now.
The judge flips through some of the pages in his file. I see that bail is set at $1,000,000. I assume you want that continued, Ms. Wasserstein?
He glances toward the prosecutor, whom I haven't even considered until this moment. A woman, with curly brown hair twisted into a severe knot at the back of her neck. She has a mouth that looks like it has no muscle memory of ever striking a smile. Yes, Your Honor, she replies. And when she stands up, I realize that she's pregnant. Not just pregnant, mind you, but in the full throes of really any day now I could drop this baby condition. Great. So the prosecutor I'm cursed with is an impending mother, one with natural sympathies toward a woman whose child was snatched. This is a kidnapping case of great importance to the state of Arizona, she says. And given that the defendant is an extreme flight risk, we feel there shouldn't even be a question about whether or not bail should be continued. I clear my throat and rise. Your Honor, we'd really like you to rethink the bail question. My client has no criminal record whatsoever, and I beg to differ, Your Honor. The prosecutor lifts a computerized record on fanfold paper, then lets it unfold to the floor. From the length of the document, you'd think Andrew Hopkins was the criminal of the century.
Would have been nice if you mentioned this, I say through clenched teeth to Andrew. There is nothing worse for a defense attorney than having a prosecutor make a fool out of you.
It makes your client look like a liar. It makes it seem as if you haven't done your job. The defendant has an assault conviction from December of 1976, when he was known as Charles Edward Matthews. The judge bangs his gavel.
I've heard enough of this. If 1 million was enough to hold the defendant in New Hampshire, then 2 million is enough to hold him in Arizona. Cash.
The bailiffs haul Andrew away from me, his chains jangling. Where are you taking him? I ask. The judge purses his lips.
It's certainly not my job to tell you how to do yours, Mr. Talcott. Who do they have running those law schools in New Hampshire anyway?
I went to law school in Vermont, I correct. The judge snorts.
Vermont's just like New Hampshire, except upside down. Next case.
I try to catch Andrew's eye as he's dragged off, but he doesn't turn around. Chris pats me on the shoulder. Until this moment, I've forgotten he's even present. That's about as good as it gets here, he commiserates. As we walk through the gate, I notice the prosecutor speaking to an older couple. What do you know about the county attorney?
Emma Wasserstein? That she'll probably eat her young. She's one tough lady. I haven't been up against her lately, but I doubt that pregnancy softened her at all.
I sigh. I was kind of hoping it was just some enormous tumor. Chris grins. At least it can't get any worse. But at that moment, Emma Wasserstein turns around, guiding the couple she's speaking with out of the courtroom. They are well-dressed, nervous. They have the cloudy confusion about them of people unfamiliar with the legal system. The man is about 55, dark-skinned, hesitant. He has his arm around the woman, who stumbles into the aisle and bumps into me.
Disculpame, she says.
The raven hair. The freckles she cannot quite hide with powder. The very bones of her face. I step back to make way for the woman who could only be Delia's mother. Courthouses are full of sounds. The squeak of bailiff's shoes, the quiet whisper of witnesses practicing testimony, the jangle of quarters, and the crank of the vending machines. But you rarely hear clapping, in spite of the fact that the best law is nothing more than a performance. So when I hear the applause, I find myself looking around to find its source. Not your finest showing, Fitz says, walking toward me. But I'll give you an 8 out of 10, because you've got a jet lag handicap. Just like that, I'm smiling from the inside out. God, it's good to see a friendly face. After the showdown with Medea in there, I'm not surprised. Where's Delia?
I don't know,
I admit. She called me to say Sophie was sick, but I couldn't reach her.
You mean she doesn't know Andrew was arraigned?
I didn't even know until 10 minutes ago, I say. Fitz blinks at me.
She's going to murder you.
I nod, and notice the memo pad sticking out of his pocket. Grabbing it, I flip through pages of notes from the arraignment. He's not here for the moral support. He's writing about this for the Gazette. Only after she murders you, I reply dryly. Well, Fitz says, ducking his head.
Want to be my roommate in hell?
We start walking down the corridor. I have no idea where I'm headed. For all I know, this could be the hallway that leads back to the jail.
You ought to go see her, I suggest.
We're living in a trailer in Mesa that's smaller than Greta's cage at home.
It's got to be better than the motel the Gazette's springing for. It's conveniently located near Sky Harbor Airport. So near, in fact, that the toilet flushes every time a plane takes off.
I take my pen from my breast pocket and reach for Fitz's hand, write the still unfamiliar address down on his palm. Tell her I'll be home as soon as I can. Tell her to call me so I know how Sophie's doing. And if you can work it into the conversation, feel free to break the news about the arraignment. As I head down the hall, Fitz's laughter follows me.
Coward!
He calls out. I look over my shoulder and grin.
Sucker!
I answer. 30 minutes later, I'm right back where I started, in the visiting room of the Madison Street Jail. Again, I've had to argue with the same woman at the entrance about my bar card. Again, I've been told to wait while my client is brought to me. This time, however, he actually shows up. Andrew lets the detention officer close the door to our tiny conference room before exploding.
Not guilty?
He accuses. The job of a defense attorney is to act in the best interests of your client. But what if you think your client doesn't have his best interests in mind? And what if, to complicate matters, your client wants something that will bring great pain to a woman for whom you would lay down your life? For God's sake, Andrew, I'd think one night in jail would be enough to convince you that you don't want it as a permanent address. His eyes flash, but he says nothing. And how do you think Delia would handle that? I add. She was a mess after she saw you for just a half hour last night. Not for the reason you think, Eric. She hates me. She hates what I did to her. Delia had been crying when she came home, but I hadn't asked her why. I'd assumed it was a normal reaction to seeing the father she loved in the confines of a jail. I hadn't asked. As her father's attorney, I wasn't supposed to. Just as I am not supposed to reveal her thoughts about this trial to Andrew. She's the one who told me to plead you not guilty. I confess. She insisted upon it. Andrew glances up at me. Before or after she saw me last night, I keep my eyes trained on his. After, I lie. Is there no end to this? He sinks down into the chair across from me, and I register for the first time the bruises on his forehead and jaw, the parallel scrape of nails along his neck. At the arraignment, I was so busy looking at the judge, I never really focused my attention on my client. He is quiet for a long moment, so that the only sound in the room comes from the lamp overhead, which is in its death throes. There's a lot going on for her right now, I say gently. You've known this outcome was a possibility for 28 years. Delia's just discovered it. She needs a little time. And she needs to know that you're willing to give it to her. I hesitate. You went to so much trouble to be with her, Andrew. Why would you want to stop now? I can see him thinking twice. That's all the opening I need. If I do what you want, he says after a moment, what will happen to me? I shake my head. I don't know, Andrew, but I'm entirely sure of what will happen if you don't. And I think my attention is caught by an inmate walking past the conference room. Through the tiny window, I make out his shoulder-length white hair, his stooped shoulders. This man must be 70, 80. This is what Andrew could become. I think everyone deserves a second chance. I finish. Andrew bows his head. Will you tell Delia what I tell you? He is asking me about the ethical tightrope beneath my feet. I can feel it, a cable of steel. Something I'm used to balancing on as a lawyer. But then I look down and remember that this man is more than just a client, that his daughter is more than just a material witness,
and suddenly the ground moves 1,000 miles farther away. What you say here stays here, I promise. Andrew nods. All right, he says. And the transaction takes place. A softening of his shoulders, an opening of his fist, a silent transfer of trust. I clear my throat and impersonally extract a legal pad from my briefcase. Well, I begin, all business. Tell me how you got her out. This is usually the point at which a client tells me, I didn't do it. Or, I swear I was just putting the car in a garage for someone. I didn't know it was stolen. Or, I was wearing my boyfriend's pants. How was I supposed to know he had a bag of pot in the back pocket? But Andrew has already confessed, and there's a trail of evidence nearly 30 years long that proves he and his daughter lived under false names and pretenses. His daughter, a woman who has 3 freckles on the base of her jaw that have always reminded me of Orion's Belt, who knows all the words to the song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, who held my hand firmly under hers and pushed down against the hard knob swelling under the skin of her abdomen and said, I'm 100% sure that's a foot, unless it's a head. Andrew takes a deep breath. I had the whole weekend with her. It was part of the custody agreement. I told her we were going to take a trip. And you know how it is when you promise something like that to Sophie. You know how she starts. Stop, I interrupt. I can't have you comparing this to me and Sophie, all right? He starts again. You know how when you promise a kid that you're going to go somewhere special. Well, it's like holding out a handful of candy. Beth was thrilled about the prospect of a vacation. Beth? That's who she was, then. I nod and write that name down on my legal pad. It doesn't suit her. I cross it off, heavy black lines. I stopped off at my apartment. I was living in a studio in Tempe after the divorce and packed up as much stuff as I could into suitcases. The rest I left behind. We just started to drive. You didn't have a plan? I didn't even know I was going to go through with it. Until I hit the highway. Andrew says, I was just so angry. Stop. If he took Delia out of revenge or spite, I don't want to hear it. If I do, then I can't spin a defense for him without perjuring myself. So you got to the highway, and what did you do? Headed east. I wasn't really thinking, like I said. We stayed at motels where you could pay in cash, and I registered under a different name every night. At some point, I realized I was heading to New York. I mean, there were millions of people in the city. Who'd notice 2 more? Delia and I went to New York City when we were in college. She couldn't wait to go back then. She said she'd never been there before. We stayed in some little hotel. I don't remember what it was called. It was close to Penn Station. I registered there as Richard Worth, and the desk clerk asked me if Mrs. Worth would be joining me. It just popped out. I said no, that my wife had recently died. Andrew looks up at me. And then I realized Beth had heard every word. What happened? She started to cry. I had to get her out of the lobby before she went to pieces, so I told the desk clerk that my daughter was still very upset. I took her upstairs to the room and sat her down on the bed. I was going to tell her the truth, explain that it was all just a story I'd made up, but I couldn't. What if Beth blurted out to the same desk clerk that her father had been lying? Anyone in their right mind would have known there was something strange going on. And I couldn't take that chance. He shakes his head, grimacing. I dug my own grave by pretending Elise was dead in the first place.
And if I'm going to be honest, the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like the safe thing to do. If Beth started talking about her mother out of the blue, or expected Elise to appear out of nowhere, or through a tantrum, all I'd have to do was turn to whoever was watching or listening and explain that her mother had recently passed away. People would immediately give us the benefit of the doubt. Sympathy, as any defense attorney knows, can be bought with a good lie. What did you say to her, exactly? She was 4. She had no experience with death. My parents were both already gone when she was born, and Elise's mom and dad lived in Mexico, so I told Beth that something very bad had happened, that her mother had been in a car crash. I said that she'd been hurt, and that the doctors at the hospital tried to do everything they could to help her, but they couldn't, and so Mommy was up in heaven. I said that she'd never be able to see Elise again, but that I would take care of her forever. How did she react? She asked whether Elise would be better by the time we got home from our vacation. I looked down at the legal pad, at my hands, at anything but Andrew. I tried to find things to do that would keep her busy. We went to the Empire State Building and the Museum of Natural History. We played on the Alice statue in Central Park. I bought her toys at F.A.O. Schwartz. I took her on a Circle Line cruise. Then, one night, I was in the bathroom in the hotel when Beth started screaming for her mother. I found her, standing at the TV, her cheek right up against the screen. And sure enough, there was Elise on the 6 o'clock news, talking into a dozen microphones and holding up Beth's picture. Andrew gets up and starts pacing around the tiny room. "I knew I couldn't stay in a hotel forever," he said, "but I didn't know what I was going to do. To buy a house, you need an ID and a bank account, and I had neither of those anymore." Then one afternoon we were walking down 42nd Street and Beth saw some flashing pinball lights at this place called Playland. She pulled me in, and I gave her some quarters for the arcade games. There was a group of teenagers in there, huddled around one girl's brand new phony ID. They sold them at the arcade. Looked like fake driver's licenses. And it got me thinking. I went up to the counter and asked the kid who was working there where I might go to get an ID. The kid shrugged and pointed to this Polaroid booth where you could pull the curtain and get your picture taken. I took a 20 out of my wallet and asked him the question again. He said he used to know a guy in Harlem, and for 40 more bucks he managed to remember the name. When I called the number he gave me, I was told to go to a Harlem address after midnight. Harlem, I say. After midnight? For $2,500 he gave me a driver's license, fake passports, and birth certificates for both of us. We got social security numbers, too. They were real identities. A father and a daughter who had died in a car accident. I almost backed out of the deal when I heard that. But then I saw the name he'd put on one of the passports. Cordelia Hopkins. Cordelia. That was the daughter in King Lear, who stuck by her father no matter what. He looks up at me. I thought it was a good omen. I tap my fingers on the table. King Lear, Cordelia, I say. You went to college, I assume? Majored in chemistry. I went to graduate school, too. I was a pharmacist in Arizona. He shrugs. I would have done it in New Hampshire, too, but I didn't have a license under my new name. How did you wind up in Wexton? Delia hated New York. We used to play a game. I'd ask her if she could go anywhere and see anything. What would it be? Andrew looks up at me. That day, she said snow. When you grow up in New Hampshire, you take winter for granted. but for a kid from Phoenix, this would be a mystery.
I drove north, Andrew says.
The car ran out of gas a mile outside of Wexton, and we walked into town. I think I fell in love at first sight. The white church and the town green, and even the benches with little brass plaques dedicated to old school principals. It all seemed like a movie set, like a place where there could be a happy ending. So Delia and I went into Wexton Savings and Loan and set up a bank account. We stayed at a bed and breakfast for a while until I got a job as a janitor at the senior center. I'd worked with the elderly as a pharmacist and thought it might be a good fit. They were so desperate they didn't even care about references. About a month later, a realtor found us a house we could afford.
The one next door to mine, I murmur.
Andrew nods.
Your mother came over with a casserole.
Actually, I can remember her cooking it. She was sober, for once, and she made a vegetable lasagna that had won her first prize in a local recipe contest. It was her standard dish to offer congratulations on a birth, condolences on a death, or a neighborly welcome. She let me put the zucchini in one layer, in the shape of the letter E, which I'd recently learned at preschool.
Your mom introduced herself and then said, Hopkins. You're not related to Eldred Hopkins over in Enfield, are you?
Andrew does not have to explain. You can reinvent yourself a million times, but the rules don't allow you to start in the center. Every life has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Dissect history, and you'll see the word that defines it as a tale, a narrative.
I lied to her, Andrew says matter-of-factly, and then to 1,000 other people. I made it up as I went along. When I said we had come from Nashua, I had to create some job down there. I had to give a reason for my wife's death. I had to explain to the pediatrician why Delia didn't have any medical records. I thought I'd get caught every single day. But eventually I told so many lies that I honestly started to believe them, because it was easier to play the game than to try to sort them all out in my head.
He turns to me, dry-eyed and resigned.
You can fool yourself, you know. You think it's impossible, but it turns out it's the easiest thing of all.
I'd sat on the kitchen counter while my mother mixed together the spinach and the ricotta and dribbled red sauce that made me think of blood. I'd watched through the window as she went up to the new neighbor's house and smiled at them, pretending she was always making casseroles for the neighborhood, as if she were some perfect sitcom mom. I was young, but even then I'd wondered how long it would take the new family next door to figure out this was all a ruse. I meet Andrew's gaze.
Yes, I say.
I know.
Fitz. I drive to Mesa in a rental car, a Mercury whose radio is stuck on a Spanish-speaking station and whose air conditioning doesn't work. When I unroll the window, wind and dust blow into my face. The temperature here is one you can reach by crawling into an oven. This is the kind of heat that changes the frontal lobes of the brain, that makes men kill each other for the smallest of infractions, that might lead a father to kidnap a child. Eric's directions tell me to turn off at University Drive, and when I do, there is a man standing at the top of the exit ramp. He has a long gray ponytail and wears a flannel shirt, in spite of the heat. He reminds me of some of the hard scrabble New Englanders who haunt convenience stores for refills of chewing tobacco and worship the late Dale Earnhardt. "Hey, bro," he says to me, and I remember with a start that my window is open. He lifts up a ragged piece of corrugated cardboard on which he's written, "Need help." "Don't we all?" I say, and gun the engine as the light turns. I pass a plethora of childcare centers, the hallmark of a town whose inhabitants have to pawn their kids off on someone else so they can be teachers and nannies and cops in upscale neighborhoods where they can't afford to live. There is shack after shack of Mexican fast food places, Rosa's, Garcia's, Uncle Tedoro's. Many of the storefronts boast sales in English and Spanish. Just past a conversion van on the side of the road that's selling leopard print dashboard covers, I see a trailer park. Stubby silver airstreams huddled like a crash of rhinos. Just as I am wondering which of these Quonset huts might belong to Delia, Sophie comes running out of one door. Her red sneakers kick up dust as she races to another trailer, this one covered with Christmas lights and feathers and wind catchers. If she's sick, she sure doesn't look it. Sophie, I yell, but she's already disappeared inside the second home. I park my car and walk up to the trailer. There is no doorbell, only the kind of triangle that ranch wives use to call cowboys to